Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, listeners. Tonight's broadcast of the Voice of Indie podcast is an encore presentation. That means no phone calls or Twitter tonight. Enjoy this rebroadcast.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Jeeves, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another Wednesday night. It is the Voice of Indie podcast, show number 56. I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me, as usual, is my co-host, Stephen Jeeves. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
I'm not doing too bad. We were up in the 90s today, kind of hot and muggy, so it's nice to sit back here with the AC going. I can't complain now.
Yeah, it's been a wild weather week. Most of my family are in the Waverly, Tennessee area up there in Humphreys County. Both sides of my family are from Waverly, either Waverly or the town next to it, McEwen. And this week they had flash flood there. 17 inches of rain fell across McEwen and Waverly and flooded the Trace Creek that runs right by two of my aunt's houses and brought a wall of water down there that has killed at least 21 people so far. And they've got close to two dozen still missing that they're looking for bodies or whatever. It's a bad situation down there. But all of my people seem to be okay, but that's no consolation for the others. And it's just ugly down there. Some of the footage, you go online and look at it, and man, what a mess. I watched one today of a woman who was live streaming on Facebook while the water was coming up in her apartment. And when it got to her waist and was starting to flow out the window, she said, I got to go. And she and her son took off, tried to get out of there, and they found her body the next day. So, thoughts and prayers for everybody out there. It's not a good situation. And this happened literally right next to where they had a massive train explosion in 1982, mm-hmm. where propane cars derailed and blew up and killed dozens of people, including the town's fire chief and the town's police chief, which led to a lot of safety things now in trains and shipping and stuff like that in the modern days. But at any rate, so yeah, the weather has been crazy this week, but let's hope that things go better for people up there in Waverly.
Yeah, I've been watching, keeping tabs on that on the news up here. So, thoughts and prayers with everybody down there. And I just want to say a little something to Verwayne Greenhoe. Most listeners know Verwayne. He's usually in the audience with his wife, Lisa. And Lisa's been having some health issues, and I got an email from him just before showtime, and they're in a rough patch right now, so they can really use your prayers if you're the praying sort. Verwayne and Lisa Greenhoe can really use your prayers. So we're thinking about you tonight, Verwayne and Lisa, and wishing you the best.
Yeah, we've made a little bit of progress on our international distribution this week. I got some good news. We now have Fresh Ink Group is contracted through a couple of its partners to have print-on-demand printing done in Japan now through the Dai Nippon Printing Company. Ooh. And Dai Nippon is ready to go. They've already got our files and everything, and they're set up, and they're pricing all of our books in yen so that they're easier and quicker to purchase through there. They sell books directly through Amazon.co.jp, which is the Japanese Amazon. Plus, they sell to universities and libraries and through brick-and-mortar retailers, including the biggest chain of all there, the Marisan bookseller chain. So we are now penetrating Japan better than we used to. Used to, you could order our books in Japan, but a lot of times they would be shipped from elsewhere in Asia. So good news. Japanese market is opening up better for Fresh Ink Group authors and a lot of other indie authors, especially those who work through Ingram, because Ingram also has a similar contract now. And this company in Japan, they say that American books sell really well there, and they're asking for children's books, comic books, study aids, literary stories, business books, computer books, and especially books on game strategy. So any of you writers out there, sense an opportunity here to expand your market into Japan, give us a talk and start thinking about ways you could do that.
Ooh, yeah. Cool. Didn't we get into China here not too long ago?
Yeah. Used to be that people could order through places like Singapore and Hong Kong or whatever, but now they're printing directly in China too. That's been since last year. So those international markets are opening up even better for distribution. Indonesia's still got some trouble spots, and there's some African countries that, you know, it's kind of hard to get into because they just really don't have the infrastructure. But otherwise, being an indie author is becoming a global endeavor now.
Indeed. And go ahead.
And speaking of which, you indie authors, we're still running our short story contest to put out books 2 and 3 in our anthology series. One contest is for short fiction, and one is for personal experience essays, where you tell, like, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5-page story about something that's happened to you in your life and find some meaning in it, you know, something that you learned or that other people could learn or something we could all identify with. So at freshinkgroup.com, we have a contest tab. Go on over there, click that tab, and start uploading some stories.
Yeah, okay. So one of our authors, Ellie Collins, we talk about her quite a bit on here because she's a talented author for young adults. She's got the Greek mythology series, and we've been turning those into audio books. Mad Max and Sweet Sarah, that's the third book in the series. That audiobook is now in production with Fig's own Sam Wilson. He's our 17-year-old marketing guy, and he's doing the voice because he fits that age gap and or the age frame, and he's doing a pretty good job so far from what we're hearing. So,
and he is a professional actor. He gets every 2 or 3 weeks, he gets parts in movies, and he winds up traveling a lot of times to either Florida or Georgia in order to film his parts. So now he's going to get to do some voice work. But if you haven't checked out that Greek mythology series by young Ellie Collins, which she's wrote from the ages of 11 through 13, it's a really good series of books. And now with the audiobooks, you not only can hear the stories told by actual teenagers, but you get music and sound effects and a lot of other nice stuff to add to it.
And those are really cool. So check it out.
Yeah.
When it's available, we'll be promoting the heck out of it. So.
Also want to remind people to get on over to your favorite retailer and order an ebook of Daedalus by Robert G. Willis-Croft, which is the first of 4 novellas in the Daedalus series. And it's called the Daedalus Files if you buy the book that's got all 4 stories in it. But that first ebook in whatever format you like, Kindle, Nook, Google Play, Kobo, we tried to cover them all, is free. Free. F-R-E-E. Get over there and order a free copy of Daedalus. Like it so much that you leave a 5-star review, and then go buy the other books in the series as well. That's Daedalus by Robert G. Willis-Croft.
And when you get it and you read it, be sure to leave those reviews. Reviews are important. They are important for other people who are buying the book to kind of gauge the situation on what other people think about it. But they're also important for the writer. Lets the writer know, hey, they're doing pretty good on this one, and they're moving in the right direction, or maybe they need to change some things up on their next book, you know, whatever. It's critiques, you know, so don't forget those reviews.
Yep. Okay, we're looking for people to call in during today's show or to post a comment on Twitter, and this is how you do it.
Call 516-453-9902 right now with your questions or comments for tonight's guest. Or post a note on Twitter with hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body of the tweet, and we'll read it on air. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group on Twitter.
Call today.
Yeah. Okay, our guest today is David Carroll. David Carroll is an award-winning journalist who has worked in Chattanooga, television and radio for more than 40 years. In addition to his broadcast work, he writes a weekly newspaper column. He has a website, which is ChattanoogaRadioTV.com, and he's authored 2 other books, Chattanooga Radio and Television, which is put out by Arcadia Publishing in 2011, and Volunteer Bama Dog, that's B-A-W-G, which was published by Fresh Ink Group in 2016. David Carroll and his wife Cindy have two sons, Chris and Vince, and they make their home in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Welcome to the show, David.
Welcome. Hey, thanks. It's a pleasure. It's an honor.
All right. You having a good day, too?
It's been busy, but, you know, this is a nice way to end it. Talking and listening to you guys is a good time. I can see why a lot of people do this.
Ah, so listeners, you've just heard who our guest is going to be every other week from now on. So, David, you're definitely a denizen of Chattanooga. It's hard to go anywhere in the Chattanooga area and not mention your name without somebody having a story to tell. But where are you from originally?
About 30 miles from Chattanooga in the northeast corner of Alabama, a little place called Bryant, which is the northeastern tip of Jackson County. Scottsboro, of course, is the county seat. And that's where I grew up, in my family's grocery store. And it's, you know, even though it's in Alabama, you know, Huntsville is about 90 miles away and Chattanooga is about 30 miles away. So Chattanooga was my media market for newspaper, TV, and radio. And I was just fascinated with that growing up. And eventually, since I started working in Chattanooga, my wife and I decided might as well move here so we would avoid all the snowy mountainous travel that happens about once every two or three winters.
Wow. So, corner of Alabama, right there in Volunteer Bama Dog Country. I'm not going to ask you which team you root for. I know better than that.
Well, and you know, that was the you mentioned the title of that second book, and that was one of the columns that I wrote for newspapers over the years, and it was based on the spot where you can stand and be in Tennessee, Georgia, and Alabama at the same time. And wrote a little story about it, got a lot of response, and it inspired me in the sense that I love those three states, you know, so dearly. And you know, and basically, when you live in Alabama and work in Tennessee, you pass through Georgia en route to and from. So, you know, I really feel like there's a piece of those states in me, and I do consider myself a volunteer Bama dog. But yes, I do root for the Tide. I mean, come on.
All right. So what was it like growing up in Bryant?
It was a great way to grow up. I mentioned that my family had a country store, and, you know, those don't exist that much anymore. But when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s, you know, that was pretty much the little neighborhood hitching post, you might say, for people to come in and talk and kill time and get to know each other. It was more than just a store. It was kind of a gathering place. And when you grow up in that kind of atmosphere, you never meet a stranger. I mean, it's basically your home, and people are coming in and out of your home all day and hopefully spending money if you're doing your job right. But it was a great way to grow up, made so many lifelong friends there. And, you know, it's in a community that, where everyone knows everybody else and everybody looks out for each other. I think our nearest law enforcement was 35 miles away in Scottsboro, and yet we had this store, supermarket, gas station, hardware for 20 years and never needed to call the police. So what a blessing that is.
Wow.
Wow.
Now, during childhood, since you're a multimedia kind of guy with the radio, TV, and writing, were you a reader and a writer as a child?
I was very lucky, and I've often told people that I was the baby of the family with two sisters who were 10 and 12 years older than myself, and I recommend that highly. That is, I mean, I can't speak for any other way of growing up since it's the only way I experienced. But essentially, I was treated like the Hope Diamond because I was the baby boy with two older sisters, and they taught me to read at a very young age, long before I went to school. I was reading things out of magazines and newspaper ads and doing car commercials, you know, at home and running around acting like I was interviewing people. And having that store atmosphere, you know, lent itself to being outgoing. I mean, you know, in most cases, someone has their groceries tallied at the cash register and, you know, the cashier sort of hands them the receipt and the transaction's pretty much done. you know, from the time I was 4 or 5, I would take that receipt and hand it to the lady and say, "Your grand total is $6.12. Congratulations." And I was a game show host when I was a kid. So I, you know, it came natural to me just in the sense that I learned to read early. I was in love with the television, you know, loved the newspaper, the comic strips, the magazines, and I was multimedia long before my time. And I think my parents just kind of rolled their eyes like, "Well, you know what? He's different. What are we going to do?" And they were right.
Yeah, that's great. And just as a pitch, I want to alert our listeners that the book Volunteer Bama Dog does have an old black and white photo of very young David Carroll at that country store. So that's worth the price of the book right there.
Absolutely. No, it's something I'm very proud of. And, you know, life was so different then, and I know people talk about Mayberry and how those days are gone, and I suppose they are. But I just feel very fortunate to have grown up in an atmosphere of love and, you know, a family that stayed together, you know, till the end, with my parents having been married for, geez, I guess when my dad died, they'd been married for 60-something years. And, you know, just, and that business atmosphere, too, taught me a lot about money and being conservative with money and not getting into debt, just, you know, things, mistakes we'd see other people make. And my dad was a good teacher in that respect. So for me, it was kind of the best of both worlds. I got to grow up and become what I wanted to be, which was a broadcaster, and yet, you know, had that small-town business background, too.
So, Beam, you want to play a commercial for Volunteer Bama Dog?
Sure, and we've got a couple of comments over on Twitter as well. We'll do the commercial here.
Fresh Ink Group presents Volunteer Bama Dog, a TV Guy's love letter to the South. I'm David Carroll, longtime Chattanooga broadcaster. Volunteer Bama Dog is a collection of my stories shared on TV, in newspapers, and online. From growing up in an Alabama country store to a long career in radio and television, I'll introduce you to the kinds of Southern characters we've all known or wish we knew. This collection of humor, history, trivia, and heartfelt memories serves up more than 60 essays. Drawing from my experiences with news, music, and entertainment, Volunteer Bama Dog is both educational and fun. It offers behind-the-scenes commentary on how we cover and deliver the news and on the music we grew up with. Among the book's highlights is a series of stories that recall Southernisms, or the Appalachian English that generations of Southerners still quote to this day. I try to bring that language to life, hoping you'll say, "I knew people who said that," or, "Wait, he's been listening to me." This follow-up to my first book, Chattanooga Radio and Television, is more of a personal account of my experiences with those many wonderful people I've met and even worked alongside over the years. I hope you'll join me as Volunteer Bama Dog celebrates the stories and people of the South. Volunteer Bama Dog is available worldwide in hardcover, softcover, and ebook formats, including iBook, Kindle, Nook, and more. Volunteer Bama Dog is proudly published by The Fresh Ink Group.
Right.
Yeah, usually we hire professional voiceover actors to do our videos for us, but we thought we'd give this guy a try and see if he could handle it. I think he did a pretty good job.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, I'm not sure where else our conversation will take us, but hearing that commercial just reminds me to say, you know, publicly, Gary, what an incredible job that you and the folks there at Fresh Ink have done on both my books, the one from 2016 that you just heard about and the one that's coming out soon. You know, if I have the opportunity to sway anybody who's looking for a publisher that will take care of you, man, I give you nothing but the highest recommendation.
Oh, thank you very much. I guess now I guess every week from now on. Now, over on Twitter, we got Robert G. Willis-Croft asked the question, what about hard science fiction in Japan? Well, you know, Robert, the Japanese market is something we're all going to have to start learning about, but maybe a good place to start would be to go to amazon.co.jp and see what they're selling there, see what the rankings are and how people are rating them or whatever. I suspect there's, you know, an audience for every genre everywhere. It's just that that Nippon company was asking specifically for more of these things that they say are their best sellers, but maybe they don't have science fiction bestsellers yet because they don't have Robert G. Willis-Croft books. But, yeah, get up there and check it out, and let's all share information about what we learned. Beam, you want to take Helen's?
Yeah, Dr. Helen Burrell, she says, fellow Inklings, goody. Other than his books at Amazon, I found David Carroll's tongue-in-cheek newspaper column. This one craftily invents parallels along the political spectrum, injecting needed comic relief no matter which party you attend. All right.
All right. Okay. And Robert G. Willis-Croft says, I've been getting several five-star ratings without reviews. I try to encourage readers to leave an actual review, not just a rating. I don't think I've ever gotten one that was just stars.
I have over on Goodreads, not necessarily on Amazon, but on Goodreads I have.
Yeah, I wasn't even sure that Amazon would let you do that. But yeah, if nothing else, just, you know, a sentence or two about why you liked it or why you would recommend it. It doesn't
That's all
take
it takes
lot.
Is a line. Yeah, just a line or two. That's it.
Okay, so we're talking to David Carroll, longtime Chattanooga radio and TV personality and journalist and basically Renaissance man of the whole corner of the state. Where did you go to school, David?
I went to high school at North Sand Mountain High School in Higdon, Alabama. My senior, and you know, I tell some jokes probably too often, but I tell people that I was in the top 20 in my class. There were 24 in my class, so, you know, that was not a real high hurdle to jump. But it was a small high school that has since gotten many awards and honors for excellence. I'm very proud of that school. And at that time, when I graduated high school, living right at the state line, the nearest university was the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. And at that time, tuition was four times higher for out-of-state residents. If you lived in Tennessee, and I can't remember the exact numbers, and of course, back in the 70s, you know, money was a different value than now, but it seems like at the time, in-state tuition for Tennessee residents was, say, a couple thousand dollars, and out-of-state residents was $8,000. And I just thought it was so terribly unfair that I lived 30 minutes in that university, and yet someone who lived in, say, Memphis or Johnson City, several hours away, would be paying, you know, a fraction of what I would pay. So needing to help my family at the store, I just decided to go to a junior college in Rainesville, Alabama, Northeast Alabama Junior College, and study business management, which is what I always figured I would do. I thought broadcasting might be a hobby, so I studied business management there and got an associate's degree, two-year degree. But that's the extent of it. I never went to any journalism school, never got a degree in communications or anything like that. I just pretty much started working in radio when I was a teenager, in addition to the store and going to junior college, and just kept staying employed, and here I am.
Now, earlier you had mentioned that your sons both are excellent writers, and as well as your wife. Tell us a little bit about your family. Are any of them published writers?
Not published writers. My wife, I met when I was in radio. I was the morning disc jockey on KZ106 in Chattanooga, 100,000-watt FM station. And I was basically, you know, the smart aleck morning disc jockey, always making fun of the news and that kind of thing. And she was the actual news person. And so she had moved here from Pennsylvania to take a job in radio news. And that's how we met, sort of through the glass, you know, the window that separated my studio from hers. So she's just an excellent journalist and went on to do a career in public relations at UTC. My two sons are just brilliant, and my oldest son is in Washington, D.C., and he is the senior writer for the American Petroleum Institute. He handles much of their marketing and public relations, writes speeches for their president and CEO. And my younger son, Vince, is in Nashville. He works for a healthcare company. And he doesn't do that much writing, but, man, when he does, he's awesome. So I'm blessed to be in a family that really appreciates the spoken word, the written word, good grammar, good spelling. I'm just, you know, really grateful to be among people who are good editors for me. Many times when I write the newspaper column or something for the book, you know, I'll run it by my wife or my sons and just say, I need a title for this, or can you look this over? And it always comes out better than I could have imagined.
Oh. So what do you do in your spare time? It doesn't sound like you have much, but you got any hobbies? You like to travel, build pyramids out of matchsticks? What are you into?
You know, I wish I had that much ambition. These little hobbies of mine do keep me busy, like writing. That's really my favorite hobby in the world. I think when I got on Facebook about 10 or 12 years ago, after complaining about my children being on Facebook and what a time waste of time it was, I realized I could have some fun with it and post some occasional, you know, jokes or comments that were hopefully amusing to people. And it kind of encouraged me to write more, which is what led to my first book and my column that I do every week. So writing, to be very honest, is my number one hobby. I don't consider it a job. And I can tell you from the income you get from doing a column in newspapers, it's definitely not a job in a traditional sense. But I guess my other hobby, other than being a ridiculous Atlanta Braves fan, is radio, which is what I started out doing and got away from it to be in television many decades ago. But about 5 years ago, I convinced a Chattanooga radio station to allow me to do a weekend show, basically telling the stories behind the hits we grew up with in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. I didn't feel like that was being done a lot on radio. Most stations were just becoming a jukebox, song after song after song, but no context. And so I thought it would be fun to have a show and, you know, play a song by, you know, the Rolling Stones and explain why Mick wrote this, who was about, you know, who he was dating at the time, you know, why it broke up his marriage, or whatever the case may be. So, and it's a lot of information that we have at our fingertips now that we didn't back in 1969 or 79 or 89. So that's been a real, not just a hobby, but a great little side job for me the past few years that keeps, it sort of brings me back to my first love. I mean, radio is just, it's addictive. It's just one of the most wonderful things I've ever done.
Wow. You also go out and give speeches, do some public speaking, make appearances here and there, including one today.
Yeah, that's another thing I love to do. And I guess that's just the ham in me. I've read the news on TV now for 30-something years, and that's been a great career, and I'm very proud of that. But unless you're on CNN or Fox News or something, you really can't be yourself. You can't give your opinions. And frankly, I don't think news anchors should give their opinions anyway. But
no.
In my case, it kind of stifled my personality a little bit. And as I mentioned, Facebook kind of helped me put myself out there a little bit, like, hey, I'm not just the guy who gives you the grim news every night on TV. I also like to have a little fun. And when I go out and do speeches, whether to be promoting a book or just to entertain a group, I don't talk about the news. And, you know, oftentimes I can almost see some faces drop when whoever's introducing me says, you know, here with us today is the anchorman for Channel 3 Eyewitness News. And I look at them, if they're not that familiar with me, sometimes they'll look at each other like, oh, crap, he's going to talk about the news. You know, can we go somewhere? And I always get up and say immediately, look, I'm not going to talk about the news. I, you know, I get paid to do that. I'm going to do it tonight at 6 o'clock, but I'm just as tired of the news as you are. Most of what we have to talk about each day, unfortunately, is not good. People who do great things get on the news, but people often don't remember that. People who get in trouble get on the news, and that's what we seem to talk about and thirst for. But when I do get to speak to a group, I like to have fun. I like to see them laugh and smile. And with these columns and books and stories that I've written, like the current one, you know, I can tell them stories that make them smile. And I was fortunate enough to do that today. So that's a nice little breather and respite from delivering bad news each day.
So then today was your rollout for the new book, Hello Chattanooga, the first time that you'd presented it to anybody.
Yeah, and it was such great fun, and I didn't know what to expect. You know, anytime you write a new book or do anything new, you know, that has some creativity or some, you know, that started from scratch, you don't know if people are going to respond to it. And you know, I told my wife this morning, I said, you know what, I may go there today and speak to this great group of people, and it may not be their cup of tea. And I may have, you know, actually came upon a subject for a book that people aren't interested in. And I said, you know what, if that's the way it is, that's the way it is. But thankfully that was not the case, and they responded very well and asked a lot of great questions and bought some books and came back and bought more, and that's what you want. I mean, if you're going to spend months or years creating something, you know, the best possible outcome is for people to enjoy it and learn from it and be entertained by it. So I'm very blessed in that respect.
What are some of the different kinds of groups that you speak before? I mean, I assume most of these are invitations to you, and then you accept them?
Yeah, and it's kind of like the joke I used to hear about a politician back in my home county. If there's two cars in the driveway, I'll go speak to them. You know, that means there's somebody there, and you know, there's a crowd. But yeah, you know, there are church groups that are a joy to talk to. You know, a lot of senior groups where you have the older members of a church who might meet once a month for, you know, home cooking and fellowship, and they like to be entertained, and they like to hear stories about the past, frankly. And since I've become a little bit of an amateur historian, you know, I like to fill that void. The group that I had today was a Rotary Club, which is a younger group and more business-oriented, and they do a lot of good work in the community. And they gather usually weekly, and they too, you know, I mean, last week I think they had someone from the local zoo. A couple weeks before that, you know, they had a financial planner. Well, today they had a TV guy telling them about 100 years of entertainment and celebrity history in their hometown. Next week it'll be something totally different. But it's a variety of groups. I'll get, you know, historical groups, retired educators, current educators. I've spoken to an autism group, you know, all sorts of clubs, civic groups, high school reunions. Deep down inside, I like to think of myself as an entertainer, and that may sound weird for a TV newsman to say that, but when I get a chance to speak to a group in public, I like to give away things. I like to make them laugh. I like for them to leave there saying, hey, you know, this news guy, he's pretty cool. I'd like to hear him again sometime. So that's my goal.
That sounds like a lot of fun. That's like musicians playing before a live audience. You get the feedback from your people.
Yeah.
It really is. And I admire people, and I'm not trying to sound, I don't know how this is going to come out. I feel like I have a talent, but it pales in comparison to people who can play and sing music and dance and act. I can do none of those things, and I regret that. So really my only talent, if it is a talent, is being able to talk and communicate and hopefully entertain and make some people laugh from time to time. But, you know, I'm like anybody else. I mean, I like to go to a show to be entertained. And when I see people who are great actors, singers, dancers, musicians, you know, I'm just in awe. And I can never, ever stack up to that. So this is just my little way, I guess, of compensating a little bit. The one thing I can do is tell stories and hopefully keep people interested for a while. If the audience, you know, isn't nodding off or getting up and leaving, it's a pretty good day.
Now, that's a good lesson for all indie authors, too. Anytime you have an opportunity to get out there and meet with groups and speak, that's how you get your name out there, and that's how you get your book out there. And David, you always do real well with people wanting copies of your book when you do these, right?
I'll tell you the thing that surprised me the most that I learned when I did the first book 10 years ago. And again, I had no idea this would happen. But when I started promoting that book, which was a pictorial history primarily of local broadcasting going back to the 1920s, Chattanooga has some iconic broadcasters, including the world's longest-running radio morning host ever, a record that'll never be broken. We've just got some wonderful characters. So when I started going out doing a program about that book using pictures and telling stories and using sound clips and things like that from the radio and TV people. You know, I knew it would strike a chord among people because people my age and a little older, a little younger, grew up watching TV or listening to the radio, and I was bringing back those memories for them. And so I thought the book would be successful, and it was. But the thing that surprised me the most was that people didn't just want to buy the book, they wanted it autographed. That was very important to them. And at the time, I was just shocked. I'm like, but I mean, I'm nobody. I mean, you know, the people in this book, they're the stars of this book. I mean, geez, all I did was throw the pictures together and, you know, kind of connect the dots with history. But I found that people really like to connect to authors, that they collect authors' books and signatures and autographs. And that was very important to a lot of people. And I had no idea the value that people put on the autograph. And once I learned that, I started really trying to make my presentations more entertaining, and that's what led to the second book, which was more humorous and using short stories, because I just developed those stories that I told in live appearances into print, and that did well, and frankly kind of led to the one I'm doing now. So it's kind of like the more you put yourself into this and the more you develop your talents for communicating and marketing yourself, it leads to bigger and better things.
Yeah. Beam, you want to go ahead and play the Hello Chattanooga commercial now?
Sure.
Hello Chattanooga, famous people who have visited the Tennessee Valley, features photos, stories, and complete listings of the entertainers, athletes, political leaders, and others who visited the area since 1900. Chattanooga has attracted some of the best-known celebrities in the world, thanks to our city's historic venues, beautiful scenery, and powerful people. Hello Chattanooga features hundreds of restored photos, behind-the-scenes stories, and thousands of fully indexed entries spanning more than 700 pages. I'm David Carroll. I've worked in Chattanooga television and radio for more than 40 years. I also write a weekly newspaper column and have written two other books, Chattanooga Radio and Television, A Photo History of Chattanooga Media, and Volunteer Bama Dog, A TV Guy's Love Letter to the South, a collection of my most popular stories. Hello Chattanooga is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in a keepsake jacketed hardcover edition with full color interior printing, soft cover with black and white photos, and all color ebook formats worldwide. Take a trip back in time, enjoy great memories, and maybe even settle an argument as you learn the dates and places that your favorite star, athlete, or president visited the Chattanooga area.
Yeah, and you know, you don't even have to be from the Chattanooga area to enjoy that book.
Oh, not at all.
I'm the one that did the indexing on it, and I can tell you, man, I was fascinated by who performed there. Some of the concert tours back in the 80s that I saw up here in Michigan played down there as well. Some like maybe a couple weeks later, some months later, but it's the same tours. So I remember all of that. And it was just really cool.
Yeah, and I had
it was really fun.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was going to say it was really fun to do the research on that because Chattanooga's unique geographical location played a big part in the book, especially in the early part of the book, where I trace back into the early 1900s, the people like Harry Houdini and Ethel Barrymore and Sarah Bernhardt, all these the big names in entertainment, prior to radio and TV, Wild Bill Hickok, the Wild West shows, things like that. But the fact that Chattanooga was sort of the railroad hub in between Atlanta, Birmingham, Nashville, et cetera, made us a natural stopping point. And needless to say, these various artists of whatever genre they might be in would look at a map and say, well, we're going to be stopping here, here, and here. Let's put on a show there. And that really helped Chattanooga attract a lot of big names in every field, from entertainment to sports to politics. They all stopped in Chattanooga.
Yeah. And what I started to say was, and I edited several hundred photos that are in that book, too, and I was feeling like this is an important responsibility. You know, these are valuable photos. These are history. And I was trying to, you know, make them look as good as I possibly could, fix scratches and, you know, brighten up colors and get everything looking just right. And I felt like I had accomplished something more than just, you know, helping David put together a book. It was like, wow, I've helped put together some history now that people will be reaching for many, many years from now. So it was even kind of an honor for Beam to be indexing and for me to be working on pictures and Lauren to be putting together the interior and stuff. So, yeah, we're very proud of this book, David.
Well, thank you. And, you know, the thing about the pictures, and Gary, as you know, well, frankly, the entire book is not really what I envisioned when I started. I envisioned it to be kind of a skinny little book that was the history of Memorial Auditorium, our oldest theater. And it seemed like I kept going down different rabbit holes until I said, well, I can't leave this one out, I can't leave this out, I can't leave this out. And I started including multiple venues from Chattanooga and surrounding areas. And the same happened with pictures. At first, in fact, I think I probably still have an email, and I told you, hey, this book's probably going to have about 60 pictures. And then one day I kind of teased it on Facebook a year or two back that, you know, I'm putting together this book of local entertainment and political history. Anybody happen to have any pictures of yourself or that you took with someone famous when they were in Chattanooga? And I thought I might get, you know, 8 or 10 more. Oh, my God. You know, suddenly, you know, word got around, hey, you know, he's looking for pictures of someone with celebrities. And so you start getting pictures of, you know, Lyndon Johnson at the airport. You start getting pictures of Hank Aaron and Willie Mays at Ingle Stadium in the 1950s, and on and on and on. People had these pictures in their collections they had taken, some more recent in nature as well. But so many of them, like I was showing them to this Rotary Club group today, one of my favorite pictures in the book is from 2007, not that many years ago. But as you mentioned, you know, people are going to be looking at this book 10, 15, 20, 50 years from now, and hopefully longer. And there's a picture of then-President George W. Bush eating at a Chattanooga restaurant
with
after he had spoken at the Trade Center on a health care summit. And it's just one of my favorite pictures. It was obviously taken by an amateur photographer. It's very candid. And it just shows President Bush and these two women who he had never met. He popped into this restaurant unannounced after his speech, a little barbecue joint, and they're just sitting there laughing. And, you know, nobody's posing, nobody's preening. It's a president of the United States interacting with these two ladies who had no idea what their lunch would be that day or who they would see at lunch that day. And it's little pictures like that of celebrities outside their usual element, just being people. And I love that kind of stuff.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, and listeners, if you get the newsletter that comes every Wednesday morning that tells you about our podcast each night and what's going on, today's newsletter has that picture in it. So scroll down near the bottom below the excerpt from Hello Chattanooga and look at some examples of pictures that are in the book, including the one of W at the diner with two laughing women just having a good old time.
Yeah. Now, David, we've heard about the fun stuff. What are your work days like as a TV anchor? Now, I think maybe some people might think you go on 10 minutes to 6, you do the news at 6, and then you get out of there a short time later. But I'm guessing there's a lot more that goes into that. So what's that schedule kind of like?
They also want to know, do you wear pants while you're on air?
Yeah, behind them.
Well, you know, you're right. It's definitely not 10 minutes to 6. It's like 15 minutes till 6. No, the truth be told, it used to be like that. When I got into television back in the 80s, I knew news anchors and other personalities who did about that much preparation, and they could get away with it. Sometimes they were either that good or that lazy or whatever the case may be, or they were that well-known and established that they could pretty much phone it in, for lack of a better term. But the TV business is like a lot of other businesses and industries these days in that we've downsized and we are doing more with less people, more content with less people. And so a news anchor these days is called upon to help write, report, sometimes edit copy, do whatever they're able to do, and try to keep up with the ever-changing technology. You know, when I got into the business 30, 35 years ago, editing was analog tape, which was very easy to learn, and the writing was fairly simple. There was no internet. There was no social media. We basically came in to produce a 30-minute evening newscast. End of story. These days, we're doing, well, for instance, when I started working at Channel 3 in the 80s, we did 11 hours a week of local programming. Now we do 48, and that's because I think of supply and demand, and that's also economically smart. We're pumping out a lot of content with about the same number of people we had many years ago, so there's much more to it than just sitting there and, you know, combing your hair and putting your pants on. there's definitely a lot of prep work that goes into it.
Okay.
So as you started putting together Hello Chattanooga, did you have any helpers other than just people answering your call for photos? Like, how did you get all the research done? Where'd you dig all this stuff up?
Well, I that's an interesting question because I don't know if I should be ashamed to say this or proud to say it, but I did it all myself. And I'm kind of glad, not that I don't trust anybody else, it's just that I didn't want to burden anybody else with the research, which was tedious at times. The hardest part was filling in a lot of missing blanks. When I started some years back, the very first venue that I collected information for was the UTC Arena. I wanted to do a website post on my website about the acts that had appeared at the University of Tennessee Chattanooga Arena, which opened in 1982. And it was incredibly easy. I contacted the former manager. He emailed me a spreadsheet of every show, the date, the headliner, the opening act, even the box office totals. And I basically cut and pasted that to my website. And it went over well. And people are like, oh, yeah, that Def Leppard show, that's the night I met the lady I would later marry. Or, hey, that's that night we all got in trouble after, you know, the John Cougar Mellencamp was in town. But it brought back a lot of memories to people. And it was so easy. And, guys, there's nothing better than being complimented constantly for doing something that was easy to do. That's the best feeling in the world. Like, I'm king of the world, you know.
Yeah.
And then people said, now do it for Memorial Auditorium. And I thought, okay, I'll contact their management and get their spreadsheet, and I'll cut and paste their shows, and I'll make people happy again. And that's where I got into trouble. Because the Memorial Auditorium opened in 1924, and had obviously gone through many, many managers, most of whom, of course, are no longer with us. And the various ledgers and records and books that were kept were scattered near and far. There were gaps where an entire decade might be missing. And it was just a nightmare. And I thought, you know, every time I would think about giving up, I'd say, you know, I've gone this far, I can't turn back. And then I would find, you know, a missing ledger or the newspaper records that would confirm some missing pieces and, you know, get that victorious feeling. But in the meantime, you know, I started adding other venues, and it kind of morphed into that huge book that we're talking about. So I guess the fact that I did all the research made it consistent. I knew what I wanted and how to get it and where to keep it, where to store it. So it was probably far more time-consuming and tedious than it needed to be. But my thought all along was, if this book is going to be good, then you know what, I'm gonna take some credit for it because I really poured years of time into it. And I thought, if this book, you know, really bombs, then I'm gonna totally take the blame because it's my baby. So I'm proud of that.
Yeah, I should be.
I think, you know, with the research, I wrote a historical fiction novel set in 1925. Clearly, I wasn't around back then, so I had to do a lot of research. The research, to me, is the fun part. It's tedious, but it's fun because you're learning stuff that you didn't know. So, I mean, to me,
exactly. That
makes it even that much more worthwhile.
Well, and that was, I can't tell you how many times I would interrupt my wife, who might be doing something far more important, and I'd say, Cindy, you're not going to believe what I just learned here. And I would sometimes say, I can't believe, you know, I've been on Earth this long and I didn't know this person had been to Chattanooga, this president had done this, that, or the other. And you're right. You know, doing the research, I guess it's like, certainly I've never been a scientist and never will be, but I guess it compares to a scientist who has been, you know, just slaving over trying to find the right vaccine or formula or equation, and then that voila moment where it's like, so this is why I've spent the last 3 months, 6 months, year, whatever it is, on this project. I had a lot of those moments.
Yeah, it's very rewarding.
Did you manage to collect a lot more pictures even than you used? I mean, might there be something with more pictures?
You know, you're not going to believe this, but the ridiculous amount of pictures that are in that book is like was heartbreaking to me, because I had to, you know, just out of sheer, I don't know, necessity, I had to cut it off somewhere. So, yeah, there were a few that missed the cut that just break my heart, because, you know, I didn't want the book to be heavier than, you know, an anvil that was getting there. So yeah, there were a lot of cool pictures that didn't make the cut, and who knows, maybe I'll find a way to use them somewhere down the line.
Yeah, it could be, and you're not kidding when you say an anvil. It is 710 pages, and it's chock full of pictures and information. And if you buy the softcover version, in order to keep the price a little bit more affordable, the pictures are in black and white. But if you buy the hardcover, dust jacketed keepsake version, the pictures inside are in color. So that's really the, if you want to have the nice version on your shelf, that's the one to get. And if you can get near David and get him to autograph it, more power to you. I know I'm going to get mine autographed one of these days.
Yeah, you know, with the book being that big, I got to say, it's user friendly. It really is. It's not like this, you know, it's not like War and Peace. So you go, oh, I got to dedicate, you know, hours and hours of reading time. It's user friendly. You can go to the index and look for what interests you, or you can start from the beginning and just kind of comb through it, and it's really cool. We do have a comment on Twitter from Robert Willicroft. He says, speaking about you, David, he says, it's a real pleasure to listen to your modulated voice, grammatically correct language use, and lack of fillers.
All right.
I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you. You know, one thing you guys brought up a little earlier that I wanted to allude to just briefly, talking about the research, one of the things that I love to share with audiences, and the group that I spoke to today seemed to enjoy this, and again, this is universal to anywhere. You don't have to live in Chattanooga. But if any of you have ever been to a concert, a play, a rock and roll show, whatever the case may be, you know that there are often people on that stage that you don't know, you don't recognize. I mean, you paid money to see the star, the lead singer, the lead actor in the play, whatever it may be. But there are other people on the stage, too, in supporting roles or backup performances. And one of the really fun parts in doing this research was going back to old newspapers and at the time when the writer might do a very thorough review of a show and would mention those bit players in the background. And in 1940, for example, the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, big band favorites, played Memorial Auditorium. And the newspaper review just gives this glowing review, detailed performances of, you know, the saxophonist and the clarinetist and the drummer and on and on. And then in the last paragraph, also performing with the orchestra was boy singer Frank Sinatra.
Wow.
And, you know, you just look at that and go, he was 23 at the time, and that was his title. He was the boy singer for this orchestra. Uh-huh. They had a boy singer and a girl singer. It mentioned the girl singer, too. But you go on 20 years fast forward, and you see that Sam Cooke and Jackie Wilson played Memorial Auditorium on a twin bill, and they were two of the hottest R&B soul acts of the 60s. And they're on stage, and they've got this backup musicians, you know, in the background that nobody can see because Jackie and Sam, you know, are out there on the front of the stage. And you read on and see that the lead guitarist was Maurice James. Okay, cool. Who's that? Well, he would become Jimi Hendrix 5 years later. and nobody knew who Maurice James was.
No.
But but you find pictures and you see this guy with a pompadour hairdo, who later became, you know, like the face of Woodstock and the hippie generation. And there were people in that auditorium that night who saw a superstar who's since become a legend and had no idea. And in more recent years, a newspaper critic did a review of a Clint Black show at Country Star at Memorial Auditorium. Opening for Mr. Black was a young man named Kenny Chesney, who looked like a little boy wearing his dad's 10-gallon cowboy hat. I mean, whatever happened to that guy, you know?
Yeah.
But I remember that line really, from doing the indexing. I remember that line.
and, you know, but you see so many stories of people who were nobody. You know, Jeff Foxworthy, opening act at the Comedy Catch for somebody I've never heard of. And it makes you realize, you know, the next time I go to a show, that young lady or young man who's up there as the opening act while everybody's kind of finding their seat, you know, that might be a star someday. I might want to pay attention to that person.
Yeah, I there's some that I've seen. I've been to a whole ton of concerts going back, you know, 40 years now. The second time I saw Alice Cooper, he had this young kid playing bass for him named Kip Winger. A lot of 80s rock and rollers will remember the band Winger. They became quite huge.
Sure.
For a run there, and this was 2 years before Winger was even thought of. He was just up there playing bass in Alice Cooper's band. Nobody knew who he was. Everybody knew who Alice was, but didn't know who this Winger kid was. But they did 2 years later.
But it's so much fun to go back and find out that Winston Churchill was in Chattanooga spending the night at our beautiful downtown hotel, the Reed House, which still stands. And to find that in 1927 he was badgered by a newspaper reporter. And basically Mr. Churchill answered the door in his night gown of some sort, and, you know, chewed out this reporter for interrupting his privacy. And I always tell my audiences, you know, you think that the media is aggressive now? You know, tell that to Winston Churchill. He had to deal with it 100 years ago.
Now, over on Twitter, Robert Williscroft adds, I agree about the research process. In my case, either I am researching some obscure Cold War event or digging into an esoteric aspect of physics or astrophysics in order to ensure my books are accurate, either historically or as a view into the future. Yeah, keep that in mind, listeners. If you're a writer, even if you write fiction, a lot of times you really need to do that research in order to have what they call verisimilitude, which is plausibility, believability in a story. I mean, it can be all made up. It could be aliens and ghosts and whatever, but you have to tell it in a way that sounds accurate and doesn't violate what they call shatter the illusion, you know? So, yeah, we agree, Robert.
Well, and I admire his dedication to research. One of the first things that I wrote in this book in the introduction was basically an apology, because I know that it's not complete. There's no way in the world that I could accurately list every famous person in entertainment, sports, politics, military, you name it. There's no way I could get them all in, because there will be gaps, there will be somebody I missed. And I say, you know, I gave it my best shot, worked on it for years, learned a lot of stuff that I never knew. And I think it's the most comprehensive list that anybody's tried to do. And sure enough, just today somebody said, do you have Golda Meir in there? I'm like, oh, no. And I looked up later, and it turns out when she was like 17, she was pictured in the local newspaper as part of a group from Egypt who had come to Chattanooga for some reason. She had no title then. She was not well-known. She was not the subject of the story. But she was pictured in the newspaper and identified, and clearly the Golda Meir that we knew as a prime minister. But I thought, okay, there's the first one. There'll be more, you know, but what can you do?
Yeah,
you know, you talked about the gaps, and sometimes there was like whole decades and all that. Did you ever have anybody come forward and say, yeah, you know, you're missing the 40s for this particular venue? I was there when I was a kid, you know, and I saw, you know, so-and-so there or, you know, something like that.
Really the only significant gap that I had in going into the book was Memorial Auditorium from roughly 1933 to 1938, and even though I was able to later fill in some of those gaps, I remember thinking at the time, you know, let's face it, most anybody who was at a show at Memorial Auditorium in 1934 is probably no longer with us, which is a callous thing to say, but it's true. As it turned out, I was able to gain access to some newspaper archives that helped me fill in the gap. But the actual records from Memorial Auditorium at that time are long, well, they're just no longer available. But I was able. One of the cool things that I was able to do with newspaper archives was fill in another gap that I was concerned about. Because back in the 50s and 60s and even the 70s, radio stations would stage multi-star concerts at venues around the nation. And they would be sponsored by a radio station. It would be called like a spectacular, a shower of stars, a caravan. And it would include the most popular acts in country music or top 40 music, whatever the radio station's format might be. And in most all of the auditorium records, it would just say that. It would be like 1965, June 15, Caravan of Rock Stars, you know, July 17th, Cavalcade of Country Stars, and on and on. And I would be like, oh, no, I mean, you know, who am I missing here? And again, once I gained access to more daily newspapers, I was able to actually look at the ads or the post-show reviews of those shows and start filling in the names of Hank Snow, Eddie Arnold, Paul Revere and the Raiders, and all the others. So those gaps were filled and are in the book.
Yeah, you know, on the internet, nowadays they have these all kinds of websites that deal with, you know, the, what's the word I'm looking for? Kind of like the logs of these places. I found this for our local venue that's no longer here, the Lansing Civic Center. And it told you the date that it opened and who was the first people that played there, the opening act. And it's all the way through until it closed and then they tore it down. And I noticed this for a whole bunch of them. And some of these will actually even give you like a band like Iron Maiden. I looked them up and it told me when I saw, I've seen them a few times, but the first time I saw them, it told me, you know, it gave me the option to find the, like the set list. So I was able to even go through the entire set list of what they played that night. And it, it was just really cool because there's so much information out there now.
Yeah.
And the only dangerous part about that I learned, and I don't, I hope none of it comes back to haunt me because I tried to check and double check these. In some cases, not many, but in some cases, some of that information is unreliable in that it, some of those websites are based on either posters or newspaper ads or even anecdotal memories that some people have posted on social media. And what I learned, for example, I can't tell you how many people told me that Elvis played Chattanooga. Well, I tried. I mean, I've researched Elvis until I can basically tell you, you know, what his shirt size was, but he did not ever play Chattanooga. Spent the night there once, and that's in the book, but, you know, did not play it. And there were many shows that I would, in the course of doing newspaper research, I'd say, wait a minute, you know, Linda Ronstadt was at, you know, Memorial Auditorium on April 25th, 1974. Man, I've got to add that. And then in doing a little follow-up research, I might see in a follow-up story a day or two prior to the concert or a day or two after the date, you know, she canceled or, you know, weather kept her from performing or whatever the case may be. So, you know, I've learned kind of the hard way that sometimes, you know, just because you see a poster or some ad that so-and-so is going to be performing at such-and-such arena, it may never have happened.
Yeah, that's a
good point.
So the cover of the book, those of you who get the newsletter got to see the cover in today's newsletter. Our guy Sam makes sure you see all our new covers at least two or three times in that newsletter. You got to give that to him. the picture that you wanted to use for that, what is that picture, David?
I got so many compliments about that picture today. I mean, I'm just in love with the look of that book. It's beautiful. I'm, as you may have learned from knowing me a little bit, Gary, I am the worst at coming up with a title and a cover. That's the hardest part of a book, to me anyway, and I don't know if anybody else listening has had that experience, but I will absolutely lose sleep over coming up with a title and or a cover. And that was the case with this book for about 2 or 3 years. The title came late in the process, but the cover, if all those pictures that I had access to, I would look at them and say, is this a cover? No. And I would just almost be like, you know, dear God from heaven, just drop a cover down on me, you know, just out of, see if a miracle happens. And not long before the book was finished, I spotted this picture, and it was taken, it was actually used on the Tivoli Theater's Facebook page. And so I did a little research that they didn't really have an artist name, but there was a picture of two performers taken from the rear of the stage facing the audience. You see audience members cheering. You see this spotlight headed toward the stage that creates kind of this light blue heavenly glow. And it's just a perfect picture. So eventually I was able to track it down and find it's the group For King and Country, which has done some pop and contemporary Christian music, and they have a strong following. And they were so kind to give me permission to use this picture as the cover of the book, because to me it's just like, you know, we have created a good book with good content, and now we've put, you know, the perfect ribbon, the perfect bow on the package. It's just fantastic.
Now, we know that you've got to cut out here pretty soon because you have to pick your son up at the airport. Do you have any advice before you leave for writers and even the media, those who might want to get into radio or TV?
Well, on the last part first, the good news is, compared to, say, 10 or 12 years ago when I would have advised against getting into radio or TV, now I would say go for it. And if you are especially a writer, if you take pride in your writing, if you take pride in your grammar, your skills in assembling a story, a beginning, a middle, and end, there's a job for you in TV news like never before. And I only learned some of this today. CNN, for example, has just announced a huge hiring initiative in Atlanta. We're talking about more than 200 job openings for people who can write, edit, and produce news. I mean, this has never happened before. And local TV stations like mine are struggling to find young people who are willing not just to report, but also to be behind the scenes and produce, write, and edit the news. So it is a growing field. It is a good way to make a living. I think it's an honorable way to make a living. Probably my least favorite term in the world right now is fake news. That's not what I do. That's not what my coworkers do. We're proud of the content that we put out there each day. So I would definitely say go for it on getting into the broadcasting and journalism field. And as far as writing a book or getting into writing, I'll just say it's the best decision I ever made. It has enhanced my life. It has completed it in the sense that I feel that I'm accomplishing something when I finish a column, a story, a book. It's so rewarding, and it's, I guess the best way of saying it is it's just a great way to express yourself. I remember some columnist years ago that I admired said that you basically cut a vein and let the blood flow every time you write, because it's truly, you know, from your heart, from your body, your soul. And I truly believe that. There's just nothing better than the feeling of starting with a blank screen or sheet of paper and then turning it into something people enjoy.
So anybody who wants to talk to David Carroll, send a note, ask a question, anything like that, we do have a contact form at freshinkgroup.com. But otherwise, David, how do people find you? Is there a way to contact you? Where do they find you on social media? What's your website, Facebook, Instagram? Where are you out there?
Probably the easiest ways, I'm on Facebook at DavidCarroll3, which is pretty easy to remember. That's also my Twitter handle, DavidCarroll3. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll get access to my little 280-word essays of the ups and downs of life as a Braves fan, and other little comments on pop culture and the news and whatever. My website is probably the best way to reach me, ChattanoogaRadioTV.com. There's an archive of about 500 columns I've written over the years, so you can kind of go back to the beginning and say, wow, he's really declined in his aging years. Yeah, maybe so. But anyway, I do a new column every week, and it's on ChattanoogaRadioTV.com. And I'm on the radio on weekends on noon to 2 Saturday and Sunday, noon to 2 Eastern, Big1069.com. I'd love for you to listen to the radio show.
Definitely. Now, those two commercials that we played earlier, those are book trailers that include video and show a lot of the pictures that are in these two books, Volunteer Bama Dog and Hello Chattanooga. Those are in our YouTube channel. Get over there, Fresh Ink Group, and check those trailers out as well.
Yeah. Well, David, we do thank you for stopping by and sharing some of your time with us tonight and with our listeners. We appreciate that.
Yeah.
Well, it was a pleasure, and I really appreciate all you guys do for writing and for journalism and education. Just keep up the great work, and hope to work with you all again soon.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, okay, listeners, the archives, you know where they're at, beamweeks.com, freshinkgroup.com, stephengees.com. Just hit the podcast tab, and you'll find them. Go over to the YouTube channel, Fresh Ink Group, and hit the like and subscribe buttons while you're over there. And we're also on Spotify.
Yep. And if you want to get that weekly newsletter I've told you about, go to freshinkgroup.com, scroll down to the bottom of the homepage, fill out the little form. Who we got next week, Beam?
Next week is author Michael Lyons. He's a talented writer, and tune in.
And the week after that, on the 8th, we've got Tammy Trover, who put out a children's book about surviving cancer. It's for children and adults, families, friends, people like that. And it's got poems with Cornelius, the cancer-fighting crocodile. It's an excellent book. So we'll have Tammy the 8th.
All righty. So on the 15th, we are going to have, had to check that date, on the 15th, we're going to have an encore episode with Stephen and I, kind of interviewing each other, because we're both going to be on the road. So tune in for that if you missed it before. Some fun stuff, talking about writing and whatnot.
Yep. And then after that, we've got other guests scheduled or being scheduled, including author Patty Wiseman, who does everything from romance to children's books, and author Jay Ash Looney, who we have a number of his books. We have some of his plays that we've published and a couple of his word books, which are selling very well in India. And you've heard us talk about his upcoming book, Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy, which is 65 excerpts, page-long excerpts from the memoirs of famous and infamous women. And we've got 65 beautiful pieces of artwork that goes with those as well. So we'll have Jay Ash Looney on as soon as that book's available.
Yeah, well, everybody, thanks again for tuning in. We do appreciate all of you who do stop by, and whether it's in the archive or live. And we ask that you tune in again next week and support us, help us build this thing. Follow us on Twitter, at Voice of Indy, at Fresh Ink Group, and have a good rest of your week, everybody.
Yeah, and if you have not subscribed to the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, get over there and do that. We hit 150 subscribers this week, which is not a real impressive number, but pretty good start for us. So thanks for everything, everybody. Thanks for the support, and we'll see you next week.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.